You're listening to Red Eye on Vancouver Cooperative Radio, CFRO 100.5 FM.
How did junk food get its name? Junk food items are usually filled with some of the least nutritious ingredients, many of them not necessarily food in the dietitian sense of the word. Junk, it could be said, is what junk food does to one's health, or the health of populations at high junk food risk. And junk food risk is something that Gerardo Otero is currently trying to map across countries. Gerardo Otero is a professor of sociology at Simon Fraser University, and he joins me this morning by phone. Good morning, Gerardo.
Oh, good morning, Mordecai.
Many of us are conscious of making choices around whether or not we eat junk food as individuals, but you're looking at junk food consumption on a countrywide basis. So tell us what junk food corresponds with, is connected with at the population level of a nation.
Well, let me first say that I guess the counterpart of junk food is food security. And food security has been a notion that has been in vogue since about the 1980s. And the whole point about food security is it's defined this situation when all people at all times have physical, social, and economic access to sufficient, safe, and nutritious foods, which meets the dietary needs and food preferences for an active and healthy life. So when you started the program, you mentioned junk food as not meeting the nutritious aspect of from a dietary perspective. So my point is that, while food security continues to be an issue for about a billion people in the world, out of about 7 billion, 1 billion continues to suffer from insufficient access to food. But what I'm trying to get at is that a very large number of people, anywhere from 2 to 5 billion, I would say, have another type of risk, which is while having sufficient access to food, that food may not be as nutritious as necessary for a healthy life. And it is not a matter of choice, because particularly for low-income people, they cannot afford the fruits and vegetables, that would be the most healthy food, simply because it's too expensive. And that's where we get into the terrain of what nutritionists call energy-dense diets, which, in other words, are, foods high in content of fat and what you might call empty calories. So, they keep you going, but they're not very nutritious.
And in your research around this junk food risk, you're trying to establish a way of measuring and comparing countries and populations on that risk. How does this relate to liberalization of the global food markets? Is that an important factor?
Very much. In fact, that's one of the key points, that the time when the food security concept came up was a time when the world was moving into neoliberalism, which is the reason why I'm calling these the neoliberal diet, a very energy-dense diet. And the whole point was to change what had been happening since the aftermath of the Second World War, which was a situation in which, while many other sectors of the world economy were becoming liberalized, agricultures were all focused in their nation states. So it was an inward-looking type of agriculture, high protectionism, a lot of supports for farmers, and so on and so forth. And in the 80s, the suprastate organizations like the World Bank, the UN Food and Agriculture Organizations, they were all trying to introduce trade as the key form of achieving food security. They were trying to liberalize the sector. And that was as opposed to the self-sufficiency model that prevailed before. And the theory was that if each country took advantage of its comparative advantages, the whole world would be better off. But the fact is that the advanced capitalist countries, United States, Canada, Europe, Japan, they had the talk of liberalizing, but they continued to practice protectionism to the tune of many billions of dollars. So just to give you an example, Mexico in the late 1980s opened up its agricultural trade market unilaterally, and it ended up with a very heavy dependence on the importation of basic foods. So when the food crisis hits in 2007, Mexican food becomes extremely expensive.
We have that neoliberalization and the self-sufficiency and the food security is destroyed for so many people in the world. When you're going around now trying to compare different countries by this junk food risk index, what do you put into your criteria that you are resulting in an index where you can compare and rank countries as to the degree to which they're at risk of collective sort of junk food consumption?
Let me just clarify one thing before I mention the components of the what I'm calling the junk food risk index, which in a way would be a way to measure the impacts of the neoliberal diet. But one point is that there's also a lot of talk about overweight and obesity as even an epidemic. You know, that's a word that's being used for the United States, for Mexico. I mean, Mexico has like a 10% of the population has diabetes, which comes, you know, straight from overweight and obesity. So, I mean, that's one of the reasons why this is a relevant point. So which are the components of the junk food risk index? That's something that I'm still working out. I'm trying to refine it, but there are, so far, four main components. One is what I call a dependency index, a trade dependency index, and that has two sides to it. One is import dependency, and the other is export dependency. Because either way, you know, if a country imports too much of its food, or if it exports to a lot of its food, and by a lot I mean 20% or more of the domestic supply. By doing that, the country becomes it imports the world price of food. So once, let's say, you know, the case of India, for instance, is one of the largest exporters of rice. When the food crisis hit, actually, the government had to close the borders, you know, to the exportation of rice, so that prices wouldn't increase that much in India. But they still did, because producers become dependent on the higher prices for exporting their food. You know, so they don't want to sell as much to the domestic market, which, you know, doesn't have as much purchasing power. So that's one component. The other component is the Gini coefficient. I'm taking that as a proxy for the Gini coefficient is a measurement of inequality. Zero would be a situation in which everybody has the same after-tax income. One is a situation in which a single individual commands all the income of a nation. All right. So obviously, the figures are somewhere in between, and you know, like Scandinavian countries, they have indexes around 21-25%. Canada used to have rates similar to the Nordic countries. Now it's been increasing since 1996 at a higher pace than the OECD countries. But Mexico's is much higher at about 50%. The U.S. Gini coefficient has also been increasing quite dramatically. And so the purpose of the junk food risk index is to try to assess the risk specifically for working classes. Because one assumption is that the middle and upper income classes, they don't have a risk. I mean, they do have the choice of eating junk, but they don't have to because they have the means to buy healthy food. But not necessarily the low-income classes. And there's a lot of studies that have established a very strong correlation between low-income and low education levels on one hand, and a much greater exposure to what nutritionists call energy-dense diets. So, I mean, that's there already. You know, I'm just trying to assess this on a comparative basis between 1985, which is around the time of the neoliberal turn, and in 2007, which is right before the food crisis hit. And, for all the countries I've been comparing, and this is just eight of them, Canada and the United States as agricultural powerhouses with emerging economies, in all cases except Brazil, the junk food index increased.
Let's have a look at a couple of those. The United States, is it that it is its population is not benefiting but is in fact suffering from the neoliberal policies?
Yes. The United States, one of my arguments is that at the same time that it is the dominant country economically, it's also the dominant country technologically, and it's also the dominant country in terms of the dietary patterns. I mean, in a way, the United States is imposing, or to put it less strongly, perhaps it's diffusing its mode of eating throughout the world. I can give you some figures on the expansion, for instance, of fast food restaurants. You know, Subway has almost 40,000 establishments around the world, more than McDonald's, which is at about 33,000. KFC has about 17,000. Pizza Hut, almost 15,000, and so on and so forth. And the U.S. is the most overweight country with the highest rates of obesity. And this is measured by what nutritionists call the body mass index. However, Mexico has been even more affected than the United States, at least proportionally, since from 1980 to 2008. The rate at which the percentage of overweight adults increased was 31%. And in the United States, that rate was 24%. Mind you, the United States was already more overweight than Mexico at that point. But the rate at which this is becoming a problem is, you know, much worse for Mexico. And Brazil, 26%, South Africa, 26%.
You said that Brazil was a country that hadn't been increasing its junk food risk. What would have made a difference between Brazil, let's say, and Mexico, or even the United States itself?
Okay, that's a very good question, because it has to do with state policy. And, I mean, I think a lot of these boils down to state policy. Much of the neoliberal diet has to do with, like I mentioned, you know, very heavily subsidized agriculture. So in the case of Brazil, you had a very progressive government entering power in 2002, which had a concerted policy to reduce hunger, and not just by, you know, funding people's food, but also by making deals with a very important agrarian movement, perhaps the most important social movement in Latin America, which is called the movement of the landless workers in Brazil. And they have managed to get land from land reform, and they have an agroecological program of production. So they try to engage in sustainable agriculture, ecologically sustainable. And the Lula government, which is now continued under the new government as of 2010, these producers from the landless movement of the landless are making deals with school districts, and so they're providing schools with fresh, healthy food. So I think that, along with another factor, which is the Gini coefficient that I mentioned is part of the junk food risk index, the Gini coefficient has gone in the opposite direction of the Gini coefficient in the United States. It's gone down. In fact, there's a very interesting graph that was published by The Economist, with Brazil's Gini going down and the U.S. Gini going up. So you could say that the United States is becoming an underdeveloping society.
So what I take from this most importantly is that social policies, economic policies, political decisions are the key factors, and in terms of the general presentation of junk food, it comes like many things that are dealt with, environmental questions and so on, individual responsibilities is presented as the solution to the problem, and you're saying the solution comes from a political perspective, and the social programs that are introduced and the effort to create more equality between people is the way to address the question of junk food risk, not only in the developed world but in the colonized worlds.
Yes, absolutely. So I would argue that the whole discourse about choice is, you know, just a liberal fantasy that people actually have the choice of eating good food. Most people do not, and particularly low-income people do not have much choice. And I think this has come to a head in Europe. You know, there are 16 countries in Europe that have found horse meat in a lot of processed foods, like pre-elaborated lasagna, for instance. And, you know, that's the kind of food for people, low-income people, perhaps everybody in the household working, they don't have much time to prepare the food, so they have to buy, you know, like the TV dinner type of food. And I guess the assumption of the producers is that these people won't even know what they're eating. You know, they think they're eating beef, but really it is beef mixed with horse.
Well, thank you very much, Gerardo. I appreciate this clarification and wish you luck with your ongoing research on this.
Thank you very much.
Gerardo Otaro is a professor of sociology at Simon Fraser University, and his current research project is to create an international junk food risk index.
This podcast was produced by the Red Eye Collective in Vancouver, BC. If you live in the Vancouver area and are interested in creating alternative radio with us, we'd love to hear from you. Contact us at redeye@coopradio.org.